local talk about local issues. It's the Gary Bouton Show on the AJR News Network.
All right, Spike, you ready to have some Thursday fun? Why not? I don't know how much fun it's going to be, but welcome, everyone, to our Thursday edition. Spike Nesmith is with us in studio handling production duties. Mike King on our phones. Brittany Murray News, pretty much the same lineup as every day, but I like to give them a little tip of the hat, pat on the back. It's National Pick-a-Pathologist Day. I know, yeah, it's the same look I had. That's a little sick, a little morbid. But, yeah, there's a, you have a friend that's a coroner. Why not? Don't have any, but maybe I'll start looking. National Guard Day, a little bit more important. National Guard actually grew out of the militias that were put together back in the probably 1600s when the colonies needed protection and there wasn't any national army yet. So militias eventually led to National Guard. So there you go. Today's the birthday of National Guard. On our show this morning, we're going to talk about, we're talking in general about the Office of Energy, a little more specifically about alternative fuel programs and some of the vehicles on our roads. Kelly Bragg is a development specialist with our State Office of Energy. She'll join us in a moment. And then we're going to talk to a couple of students. Always fun to talk to students who are attending college in our state, who are from our state. Both of these are young people who are West Virginia natives. One a student at Fairmont State, another a student at West Virginia Wesleyan. Two entirely different topics, and we'll get to that later as to what they're here to talk about. But I thought it'd be interesting to get the viewpoint of, you know, some young people on a couple of topics that are important to them, certainly. And in the case of another, important to all of us, I think, is it deals with our political climate in this country and around the world. But that's a little later. First up, Kelly Bragg is waiting for us. She's on the line, and we welcome you, Kelly. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Gary. I'm so pleased to be on your show. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, delighted to have you along. I was going to start by asking you some of what you shared with the Joint Committee on Energy earlier this week, but I really don't know a lot about what the mission of our State Office of Energy is. Can you give us a little explanation of that before we roll on to fuels?
I certainly can. Number one, we are the entity that is designated by Congress to receive funding for energy projects. And our mission is actually threefold. We promote and advance fossil energy projects, renewable energy projects, and energy efficiency projects.
How do you coordinate with what the U.S. Department of Energy is doing? I don't know if I got the name right, but I assume I assume there's some collaboration there about what between what the country is doing and what the states are doing.
It's interesting because they do definitely all the programs that we're involved in with the U.S. Department of Energy focus on local solutions to local issues.
Okay.
So that has been an interesting partnership, and we have to apply for our funding. So we work with the universities, we work with energy auditors and the home builders, and now, as our topic today, alternative fuel users and providers. And we pretty much tell the federal government what we want to do, and mm-hmm. we've never had any of our applications denied.
Okay. One of the items that you shared during these interim committee meetings, as I mentioned, you spoke to the Joint Committee on Energy, was about alternative fuel programs and the increased availability, I guess is more specific, of alternative fuels in West Virginia. Can you explain how we're doing in that regard?
Yes. I became the coordinator of what's called the West Virginia Clean State Program in 2006. And back then, we had one public ethanol fueling station and a couple of older, pretty much not used, compressed natural gas stations.
That kind of died. Is it going to come back?
Well, I think it is coming back.
Okay, yeah. We heard a lot about it, then not much of anything for several years.
Yeah, the technology got better.
Okay.
And so we actually have two public CNG stations, that's compressed natural gas, one here in Charleston and one in Bridgeport. And they are they were put in by a private entity, and they service fleets throughout the country. So they stop here in West Virginia and fuel up.
Obviously, part of the equation is the number of cars in West Virginia that can operate efficiently on alternative fuels. Do you have a clue as to what that number is, or our percentage compared to other states?
Yeah, let me find my notes on that. I have been working on a project with the Department of Motor Vehicles to track all new alternative fuel vehicles that are registered month by month. So I get that data month by month.
Oh, okay.
The interesting thing is I cannot really call it cumulative data, because let's say you bought a compressed natural gas vehicle and you sold it, well, it would get re-registered.
Yeah, okay.
So we're just talking, it mostly helps me track trends. But as of November this year, we have 1,512 hybrid vehicles, 82 all-electric vehicles, 75 plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, and almost 20,000 vehicles that can use ethanol 85%. We have 10 compressed natural gas vehicles and 8 propane vehicles, and most of those are school buses.
Okay. And how do you go about working to increase that number? What do you do? How do you market it?
We our program has about 70 stakeholders, and they are made up of private and public fleets, universities, environmental advocates,
okay,
et cetera.
Yeah.
And so
the individual car owner is corporate and governmental, things like that?
Yeah. I mean, I think the individual car owner probably gets a lot of their information, you know, the regular ways, but we are certainly a repository for information on regular passenger vehicles. But you're right. The Clean Cities program is, its strength is working with fleets.
Okay. Many manufacturers, and I don't know whether it's, well, I don't think anybody knows yet what impact it might have on fleets of vehicles, be it trucks, cars, but an awful lot of manufacturers kind of working in a different direction than what you are, that being that they're eliminating the manufacturer of what we might call fuel-efficient cars and going for their bottom line, suggesting that they make a heck of a lot more money selling SUVs and pickup trucks, so that's what we're going to focus on. Obviously, that doesn't help things, does it?
Well, I mean, I always like to talk to everybody who doesn't drive an alternative fuel vehicle and talk about how important it is to drive in a responsible manner. That keeps your fuel efficiency much better. For example, you might not be aware of this, but for every mile that you drive above 50 miles an hour, you're decreasing your fuel economy at the tune of 18 cents a gallon.
Yeah.
So
I was reading some of that.
I
didn't realize, Kelly, that you got into some of that detail. I was reading some of that on, I think, on your website. But you're coaching people on how they can be more fuel efficient and save money, too, just in the operation of their vehicle, whatever it is.
Yeah, true. That's important, because not everybody can afford the premium on some of these vehicles, and some people don't have the fueling. But I would like to say that, you know, while it is true that some of the American automakers are shifting away from sedans and more toward SUVs and trucks, there were 42 models and 20 makes of electric vehicles sold in September 2018. So several of the automakers are moving over to electric vehicles.
And I think you sent me a note on hybrid cars, which the article indicated aren't a total answer to fuel efficiency, because they sacrifice efficiency by having that small gas engine backup, right?
Yeah, that's what the article said. You know,
you read it too.
Certainly, the Toyota Prius drivers that I know boast about 55 miles per gallon and things like that. So.
Yeah.
You know, it is, as in most things, it's what people want. But if you consider the fact that we would really like to use domestic energy sources, and in particular in West Virginia, electricity, natural gas, and propane, you know, then it starts to make real sense in terms of an energy independence and energy security aspect.
The state has made inroads in electric cars by providing more stations, I guess we'll call it, where people can recharge their electric cars? I think even did Tesla even help fund some of that?
Yeah, our office paid for level two chargers at all the lodged state parks, and we used our federal dollar for that.
Okay.
Tesla got wind of it and spoke with the DNR about coming down and putting in Tesla destination chargers. And you might think they would only charge Teslas, but in this particular case, we asked them to also include a plug for other vehicles.
That would make sense. Are they being used? Do you have information on that?
Unfortunately, we didn't network them. And what that means is we don't have a way to track individual usage. But anecdotally, we are hearing from the state parks that they are getting more visitors, particularly at Kekapin State Park, which is near D.C.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I read a note, too, that, and obviously your department can't do anything about specific vehicles, gasoline, I want you to explain this to me, gasoline gallon equivalents between 2016 and 2017 dropped 70%. What exactly does that mean?
That is an annual report that I have to do relating to all of our stakeholders. And the long explanation is that... a BTU, which is the equivalent of the light and heat produced from one wooden match, you compare the BTU value of each of these fuels because they're all different. Some of them have higher BTU content, some of them have lesser, right? So the people that are using, let's say, for example, propane in school buses, their fuel is rated a little bit different compared to diesel or gasoline. So our stakeholders reduced the use of gasoline or diesel by 640,000 gallons in 2017, a 70%, we'll say, increase over 2016.
Yeah.
And I mean an increase in the reduction. So that's
less gasoline used.
Yeah, or diesel, right.
That's pretty significant, I would think.
It really is. I mean, you were talking about being compared to other states, and, you know, states with larger populations, more population density, I mean, you know, you're going to have different numbers, but my personal goal is to get us to 1 million gasoline gallon equivalents reduced, and I hope we're well on our way.
Yeah, great. Another thing that you mentioned to the Joint Committee, and we're getting close on time, but I wanted to get this in, was a public-private partnership with Sheetz, and they're pretty much in all corners of the state, I guess. They might not be everywhere yet. They're certainly up in the North Central area here. Can you explain how that will work?
Yeah, it's already working. They've already installed, I think, 100 dispensers at 22 Sheetz locations, and those dispensers will not only give you regular gasoline, E10, they will also give you E85, which is 85%, and can only be used by flex fuel vehicles. You have to check your manual or look on the badge on your car. But they also use an ethanol blend called E15, which is 15% ethanol.
Okay.
And cars newer than the year 2000, again, check your manual, can use that fuel.
So they're going to help you get to your 1 million gallon number, right?
Let's hope so.
Hey, real quick before we go, Kelly... does the announcement yesterday of Senator Manchin taking over the top Democratic role on the Senate's Energy and National Resources Committee have any bearing or benefit to the work that your office is doing?
Well, there is a move among the Clean Cities coordinators to visit Washington every year. We have not done that. We chose to... educate in a different way, but I think with him being there, maybe we'll drop in and see him.
I don't think it can hurt, right?
I don't think it can hurt.
Kelly Bragg is Energy Development Specialist with the West Virginia Office of Energy. Interesting stuff. Thanks, Kelly. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, Gary. Have
Absolutely.
A good one.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we return, we're going to check in. I mentioned we've got a couple of students we're going to talk to today. Tyler Keller will be with us. He's vice president of student government at Fairmont State University. He's a junior. And he made a pitch to the school's board of governors explaining that textbooks, which sometimes fall out of the realm of what scholarships can pay for, the cost of textbooks has become too expensive for some young people. So expensive that some young people have to walk away from college, which is not a good thing. So Tyler will join us right after this.
And now, back to the Gary Boughton Show on the AJR News Network.
Tyler Keller is a junior at Fairmont State University and Vice President of Student Government. We welcome him. Tyler, thanks for calling in this morning.
Hey, Gary, I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. You're from Moundsville, right?
Yes, sir.
I mentioned at the top of the show that both of the students we're going to have on our show today are West Virginians, born and raised. Were you born in that area?
Yes, sir, by my nature, up there in Wheeling.
Oh, okay, good. All right. You made a pitch to the Board of Governors at Fairmont State recently, essentially saying that, you know what, textbooks have become too expensive and not all of the scholarships that these students come to school with cover the cost of textbooks. Makes sense that this would be a problem for young people in this day and age. What motivated your appeal and then pitch to the Board of Governors?
Right.
Other than the high cost of textbooks.
Yeah, right. That's exactly what we did. The president of the Student Government Association, Dylan Bradley, he and I have worked pretty diligently on this. We see this issue all across our campus. It's actually one of the biggest issues we face on our campus, along with parking, which obviously is not nearly as serious.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, as you said, it's the highest out-of-pocket cost for students. According to the College Board, an average student will pay $1,200 every semester for books. You know, it's not covered by the FAFSA, which is the free application for federal student aid, and a lot of scholarships don't take it into account. And so, you know, we see students not returning to school for this reason. You know, talking with some of the administration on campus, you know, we're always looking to improve retention rates because, you know, that's the way forward in the state for higher education. And, you know, for freshman year and for sophomore year, retention rates are about, on average, at Fairmont State with the national average. You know, we'd like to do better, but we're about where we should be.
Mm-hmm.
But for the junior year, between sophomore and junior year, retention rates plummet, and that's because a lot of these scholarships and a lot of the money that's assisting students, they're two-year scholarships, which is pretty normal for a regional university like Fairmont State or other regional universities in the state like West Liberty, you know, Glenville, Concord.
Sure, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and so we see this big plummet in retention, and our biggest goal and our biggest incentive is keeping students, you know, in college and being, you know, having them able to afford their textbooks and their other classroom materials.
We're talking with Tyler Keller, who's Vice President of Student Government at Fairmont State University, and we're talking specifically about the high cost of textbooks. Some of the background research you did, Tyler, what did you find out about the reasons that some of these scholarships don't pay for textbooks? I mean, it's part of the cost of going to college. If you've got to have a textbook to attend the class, seemingly that would be part of the cost of going to college.
Right, right. You would think, and that just, I guess, makes too much sense. But,
yeah, $5 million question, yeah.
Right, right, right. And so, you know, well, I guess we should start with what these scholarships and what federal aid does cover. It covers your tuition. It can help cover your room and board. It covers your fees for classes. Classes will have an enrollment fee or a lot of times
a lab fee.
Yeah. Right, correct.
And, so you can go to lab, but we're not paying for your book.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and actually, we've been looking at several options, and one of the options is actually to sort of give you the concise version, it's an online textbook resource. It's called Cengage Unlimited, and it would be $120 per student per semester, which would, you know, be leaps and bounds better than where we're at now. And basically, the idea from the university is something we've discussed and mulled over, is using that, having that $120 just be incorporated as a college fee, right? As a fee for, so that way it's incorporated in all of your student aid.
Is that online option an institutional decision, or is it decided at the teacher professorial level?
Right. Yeah. Actually, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because the biggest issue that we had with student government is that we didn't want the university to think that we were, or actually more specifically the professors, to think that we were just going to come up with one blanket solution, because that's not at all what we're looking to do. We believe that this can be a department-to-department decision or a college-to-college decision, because, as I said to the Board of Governors, what works for the College of Liberal Arts might not be exactly what's as successful for the College of Nursing. So, like I said, there's several options we're exploring. This Cengage option would be an option that would be more successful if it's implemented through an entire college. For example, our business college actually has been totally digital over the last year. It's been pretty successful. Now, the College of Liberal Arts, because their books are so class and policy specific, professors have said they've had a hard time actually finding books for that, and that's okay. But the books in the College of Liberal Arts tend to be much cheaper than, you know, than the textbooks for nursing or for business or for aviation even. So we're trying to decide what's best for each, you know, each set of students, each set of professors. You know, like I said, what might work in one college might not work in another. And we're trying to be as flexible as possible and present as many ideas and hear as much feedback from all students, professors, administration, and the Board of Governors.
Tyler, I got to hit a break here. Hang on for us, though. We're going to talk more about this, okay?
All right, sounds great.
Time to check headlines around the state. It's your Metro News Update. We'll be back.
Your daily dose of sanity. The Gary Bowden Show on the AJR News Network.
Daily dose of sanity when we've got kids leaving school because they get their classes paid for, their labs paid for, their housing paid for, but they can't afford a textbook. I would say that qualifies as a good definition for insanity. I don't know all the details, so I'm not throwing blame. It just seems a little odd. We're talking with Tyler Keller, who's vice president of student government at FSU, Fairmont State, native of Moundsville, a junior. Tyler, what about Promise Scholarship? A lot of students in West Virginia go to college on the Promise Scholarship. Does it pay for textbooks?
Right. Yeah, it actually doesn't.
It does not. Okay.
No, it does not. And it's purely It's purely tuition and fees. And also, even now, this actually has come up several times. It's a whole other rabbit hole discussion to talk about. But Promise actually doesn't even cover full tuition at several universities around the state anymore. Like, for example, at Fairmont State offers the Promise and Beyond. So if you qualify for Promise Beyond, it supplements the rest of tuition that Promise doesn't cover.
Fairmont State does.
Yes, sir.
That's
an institutional decision. But from the state, Promise, at most institutions around the state, it doesn't cover full tuition. So, you know, adding textbooks on top of that can be extremely difficult.
Well, so what's the reaction from the Board of Governors and from instructors? I mean, this isn't something that just happened. Textbooks were pretty expensive back when I went to college. That was a long time ago. These people couldn't have been shocked by you bringing this to their attention.
And I think honestly, it might have just been an issue that was willing to be accepted, I think, because really there's no other explanation. Because like you said, it's been an issue, it's been prevalent, it's been on campuses. And I think just recently, since Dr. Myrta Martin has taken office as president, we've really sat down, it's really been a data-driven conversation, and we've decided this is something we have to do, we have to find a solution for. Now, the response has sort of been twofold. The Board of Governors and the administration has been extremely intrigued and excited and interested in looking to move this forward. And then professors, for the most part, professors have been extremely supportive too. Now, there's been some pushback, and understandably so, because finding a new book, you know, maybe certain books that they're already using are offered online, and finding a new book means more work to create a new syllabus, to create a new class, new assignments, new exams, and that's understandable. But, you know, in the long run, it's going to be more beneficial not only for students, but for professors also. It's going to have the effect of a more cohesive classroom. You know, every student's going to have your textbook. You're not worried about who may or may not have your textbook. You're not going to have to worry as a professor. You're not going to have to buy a copy of the book and leave it on reserve in the library, which is what a lot of professors do because they also acknowledge the extreme cost of textbooks.
I mean, if anyone would have empathy for students, it should be some of the instructors who have spent a lot of time in college classrooms in their day, undergraduate, a lot of have master's degrees, doctorates. I would think they would give you some attention.
Right. And those professors, and, you know, so as we said before, that we don't want a blanket solution to cover the entire university that may or may not work for individual colleges within the university. Uh-huh. And so, you know, if certain professors or departments or colleges you know, if they have, like I've said before, really specific books that they don't think they can find alternatives online for, you know, that's fine. Then one option we've been exploring is older editions and price caps. Older editions, a lot of times, there's really no difference from edition to edition.
That's we haven't really talked about that. Yeah, let's talk about a book that's maybe 2 years old and wouldn't be as expensive as a new textbook.
Right, yeah, they're cheaper. There's, you know, oftentimes no difference in substance or material. We've even been mulling over and exploring the idea. This idea came from our provost, Dr. Rick Harvey. That, you know, if you're going to select a book for a class, that you are required to use that book for at least 3 years for that class.
Oh, okay.
Can't be changing editions every year.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's an option as well. And price caps. We've seen universities around the country, you know, implement price caps. So professors will say, well, I don't want to move online because really, you know, the $120 for Cengage Unlimited, I can get my students their books for, you know, less than $50. So universities around the country have been saying, okay, that's fine. For your class, you cannot require a textbook or group of textbooks more expensive than $50. And so that's being explored as well. So, you know, if professors don't want to change books, that's fine. Make sure you're meeting a reasonable price cap.
Right. And we want to make sure that we mention that this is not an issue unique to Fairmont State. I think we did mention that at the outset. Did you, by chance, collaborate with student bodies at any other state institutions to talk about this?
I'm glad you mentioned that. Fairmont student government, and actually all student governments in the state, are invited to be on a student advisory board for the Higher Education Policy Commission. And actually at that at those meetings, Dylan Bradley, the president of Fairmont State student government, myself, and the president and vice president from Marshall University, those two individuals have also been exploring how to make classroom materials and textbooks more affordable. And so some of these ideas, you know, we've actually been exchanging back and forth with Marshall University. And so it's good to have sort of a soundboard and have other students who are experiencing these problems give their ideas as well.
Yeah. Hey, Tyler, we're out of time. It's a good place to stop, but it's nice that you've taken on this challenge, and it certainly makes consummate sense that however we fix it, we certainly don't want young people leaving college because they can't afford a textbook. I would think that there would be some buy-in from alums, from the Board of Governors, from the state, from the Higher Education Policy Commission. So I wish you well, and I think it's great that you're doing this. Appreciate you joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Tyler Keller is Vice President of Student Government at Fairmont State University, a junior from Moundsville, and doing some good work for his fellow students there at Fairmont. Okay, we're going to take a break. When we return, I mentioned we've got another student. We're going to check in with a student who hails from Elizabeth in Wirt County, West Virginia. She's a sophomore at West Virginia Wesleyan, and she's going to be traveling a good ways down the road from Wesleyan here next summer, and we're going to talk about her scholarship, an award she just won, and her future travels. Caitlin Cottrell will join us right after this.
Weekdays from 9, it's the Gary Bowden Show on the AJR News Network.
Three West Virginia Wesleyan College students have been named Benjamin Gilman International Scholarship recipients for 2019. Part of that means they're going to get to travel internationally next summer. One of the winners was Caitlin Cottrell, who is a sophomore from Elizabeth in Wirt County, and has 3.95. Caitlin, you're embarrassing me. I'm not going to even begin to tell what my college GPA was. I was a little shy of 3.95, Spike. welcome. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
You actually got to head home, right? You've wrapped up your classes at Wesleyan for the holidays.
Yes, I finished my finals on Tuesday.
Okay. Well, of the three winners, I kind of singled you out, Caitlin, and I think I mentioned this to you yesterday, because you're a political science and international studies double major. And when you look at our country and our world politically and diplomatically and whatever other fashion, we've got Saudi Arabian issues with Washington Post journalists and alleged murders. We've got Britain trying to leave the European Union. We've got our country trying to renegotiate our agreements, our trade agreements. We're instituting tariffs. We're trying to build a $5 billion wall to keep people out. I thought it'd be interesting to get the insights of a, what are you, 19, 20?
I'm 20.
20-year-old on all of the crazy stuff going on in our world. How much opportunity do you get to explore some of these current events in your classes, Caitlin?
Oh, every day.
Okay.
That's one of the big parts about being a poli-sci student is keeping up on the world events. It's really necessary to your education.
Yeah. I failed to mention riots in Paris, too.
Yes.
Another little thing they're dealing with overseas. Go ahead. Were you going to say something?
I took a class, International Relations, last semester, which has helped me a lot as far as researching for Jordan and things like that.
Well, yeah, let's go back to that. Now, you won this Gilman Scholarship, as I mentioned, and one of the things it'll do is afford you an opportunity for international travel. And you mentioned Jordan. Let's go there, because one of the first questions I asked you yesterday, how in the heck did you come up with Jordan? Not that there's anything wrong with Jordan, but it's that's a good distance from Buchanan and from Elizabeth, West Virginia.
Yes, it is. I was searching for a program at the beginning of the semester, and I kind of wanted something different. Marcus and I, one of the other recipients, were talking, and we kind of just wanted to pick something that set us apart and as far as in our career as poli-sci students and things like that. So I was looking in Africa a lot, and I just couldn't decide. And so I started looking in the Middle East, and that's when I found Jordan, and I just kind of fell in love with what the culture and the opportunities there could hold.
You made a little connection between Jordan and West Virginia, did you not?
Yes. So when I was looking into Jordan, Jordan takes in lots of Syrian and Palestinian refugees, and they keep their borders open. But the country itself is very poor, and that reminds me a lot of West Virginia and what I see here in West Virginia. As far as the people, they give and they give and they give. And sometimes they don't have a lot to give, and it's really a beautiful thing.
Yeah, good observation. Let me real quick mention the other winners. I want to be fair. And frankly, one of them's from Clarksburg, so if his family's listening, they probably give me heck for not mentioning his name. But another winner, and these are prestigious. I think Wesleyan has had 7 Gilman Scholarship winners over the past 10 years, and 3 of those 7 are this year. That's pretty good stuff, Caitlin. But the other, the other 2 winners. One was Marcus Larsson, a political science and history double major from Sweden, and the third is Alexander Bradley Popovich. And as I mentioned, he is from Clarksburg. He's an applied physics and political science double major and mathematics minor. Oh my goodness, that's a lot of studying. So, tell us what you had to do, Caitlin, to qualify for the scholarship.
A big part of the scholarship was writing 2 essays, and those essays, one was on basically why you wanted to go to the country of your choice, and the other was on a follow-up service project, which the Gilman requires in order to receive the scholarship. When you return from your study abroad, you have to do a follow-on service project, and a lot of the times that's using your new perspective or your new knowledge and recommunicating it to your community back home and your campus. At your college, and just doing things like that. And then, so obviously, we had to upload transcripts and things like that, and it was a several-week process of editing our essays.
So you get a free trip to Jordan, but you will have homework.
Yes. I will be taking a course in Israeli and Palestinian relations.
Okay. And submitting these essays, you were telling me too that you got a little bit of a help with editing them and rewriting them, that type of thing, which you felt was very helpful.
Oh yes, it was very crucial. We had a great study abroad advisor, Professor Tamara Bailey at Wesleyan, and she went to a workshop over the summer for Gilman and kind of learned like what we needed to do as applicants in order to get the scholarship, and it was extremely helpful.
I mentioned that you're a great student. You've got a great GPA. I always like saluting students, too, for their volunteer work, because, frankly, all of our communities around the state and the nation need young people stepping up when they eventually get into whatever career it might be to help in other ways, not just their job, but to help in other ways in the community. And you are a Wesleyan Service Scholar. What exactly is that, Caitlin?
So the Service Scholar program is through the Community for Center Engagement at Wesleyan. And so I complete 75 hours a semester, and I receive a $2,000 scholarship a year.
Okay.
And that goes so much, it goes much farther than just those hours. You make connections in the community, and it makes this relationship between Buchanan and Wesleyan so strong, and it's just offered me so many opportunities.
Tell us some of the specific activities you were involved in, some of the organizations you worked with.
So I am on the We Lead Poverty Reduction team. I'm a team leader. So we organize advocacy events in Buchanan, and we do a lot of community dinners and fundraising for the local parish house there. And last year I volunteered at the Literacy Volunteers of Upshur County, and I got to work a lot with books and tutors who tutor those who adults who need help with their literacy.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. You're an AmeriCorps volunteer?
Yes. Last summer I was hired, and I worked for the West Virginia Energy Express program here in Wirt County, which was really awesome because I got to give back directly to my community. And I just saw a lot of growth in the children I worked with, and it was just a really good experience.
We mentioned you went to school. Did you go to Wirt County High School?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. How did you decide on relocating to Buchanan and attending Wesleyan?
I was actually between Wesleyan and WVU. My mom, she was friends with an alum from Wesleyan, and so she's like, you just need to try and visit. So I visited first and fell in love with Wesleyan. It was so personal, and the one-on-one with the professors and staff was just really what I was looking for, and honestly, it's what's put me in the position today to go study abroad and get scholarships like the Gilman.
Oh, that's great. What about back home in Wirt County? Are you involved in any volunteer work there? Not that you owe the community any more assistance, but have you done things there too, even when you were in school there?
Yes. In school, I was the president of a volunteering club. So the YLA is Youth Leadership Association, and it's based in Ohio and West Virginia. And I got to do a lot through that. And that's where I got really involved in service initially.
So when will you actually start making preparation for international travel? You've got another semester here in your sophomore year, correct?
Yes.
When do you start doing all the planning that'll be required in traveling to Jordan?
I'm actually going to start over break and just get a head start and make sure everything's in line and turn in some documents for the Gilman and just want to make sure I'm prepared.
Yeah. I mentioned to you on the phone yesterday, I would venture to say that once you've come back from that trip that you'll be easily able to explain that you're one of the only people in Elizabeth, West Virginia that's traveled to Jordan. Would you agree?
Yes. Not to my knowledge has anyone else really went to Jordan.
Yeah.
But it's a very small town, and I'm very fortunate for this opportunity.
Caitlin Cottrell is a sophomore at West Virginia Wesleyan College, and she is one of three Gilman, I'm trying to rearrange my notes here. What is the official name? Benjamin A. Gilman International Scholarship recipients, three winners this year at West Virginia Wesleyan. A big honor, and Caitlin, we wish you well and congratulate you, not just on winning this scholarship and travel opportunity, but for all the service hours you're putting in the Upshur County area. That's very nice. We thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
And have a great trip. I'm not sure we'll talk to you again. Have a wonderful experience. It sounds like fun.
Thank you.
Okay. Caitlin Cottrell from West Virginia Wesleyan College. Okay, we got to talk to two fine young West Virginia students this morning. We're going to take a break. Hoppy Kirchable is still out this week, and I believe Dave Wilson is filling in for him this morning. Dave Wilson does a show similar to mine, so he can't give us any, he doesn't have time to talk to us about what's up next, but Metro News Talk Line's coming up next. We'll be back to wrap things up right after this break. Okay, good day today on our program, and because we don't have any tees for Metro News Talk Line, we've run our show right up to the finish line this morning, Spike. As I mentioned, Hoppy is off, and Dave Wilson will be filling in today, and he does a show similar to ours in the Morgantown area, so he's on the air and can't talk to us, but we invite you to stay tuned for Metro News Talk Line. That's coming up next. We thank you for joining our show this morning. We'll be back tomorrow to do it all over again. Have a great day.